This time on your weekly constitutional.
This is the latest chapter in the saga that is Brexit. We have a new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, and he won a thumping majority in the 2019 election, and now he promises to get Brexit done. And that's what we're going to be talking about in this programme.
That was William Walton, our resident expert on all things Brexit. We've spoken with William several times over the years, but Brexit just keeps on rolling along, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson's promise to get it done. Will it get done on January 31st, or is there still more to be done afterward? I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and it's all about Brexit.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee. YWC is underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Brexit is the Energizer Bunny of British politics. It just keeps going and going and going. And thus it is with pleasure here in January of 2020 that I welcome back our resident Brexit expert, William Walton, whom I met years ago when he brought a group of students over from the University of Northumbria to learn all about United States constitutional law. We've met at several locations, notably at Montpelier, and we've had lots of fun over the years. Today we're going to talk about the fallout from the elections of 2019 and whether Brexit will finally get done on January 31st.
Let's go back to the start. 2016, we had this now landmark referendum on the question of whether the United Kingdom would continue to be a member of the European Union. And we've spoken a lot on this program about what the European Union does and why, to differing degrees, there was resentment from British people towards the European Union. As you know, that referendum came down, albeit quite finally, but it did come down on the side of departing from the European Union. And David Cameron stepped down as leader of the Conservative Party and as Prime Minister. Theresa May was elected or emerged in the Conservative Party contest as a new leader, committed really to honouring the will of the British people. And of course, we've had the difficulty over the following 3 or 4 years as to what the will was. It was to leave, but we never really resolved how to leave. But anyway, and she put to Parliament 3 attempts at producing a withdrawal bill, which was the means by which we leave. Resolving the 3 issues, the 3 preliminary issues, which were how much we owed the European Union in terms of money, outstanding payments, what would happen to European citizens living in the United Kingdom in terms of their status? And then thirdly, this huge issue, but it wasn't really recognised at the time as to how important it would be, concerning the operation of the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And again, just to remind your listeners, the reason that's an issue is because, of course, Ireland would remain a member of the European Union. Northern Ireland would be part of the United Kingdom and would be outside of the European Union. I'm sure all your listeners know about the legacy of the Troubles, the terrorism, etc. And the border issue is very contentious. And the border is now an open border with the peace treaty, the famous Good Friday Agreement signed in the days of Tony Blair and John Major. But it's an issue which could flare up again. And so it has to be treated with incredible sensitivity. And Theresa May was not able to get a majority of parliamentarians to support her 3 different attempts to get a withdrawal bill through the House of Commons. The first time it was defeated by historic number, I think 220, I think it was 432 to 212, I think was the figure, something like that. Second time, it was defeated by about 160 votes, which was the second largest defeat by government in British parliamentary history. The first time, of course, being the largest. And then at the third time of asking, I think it was defeated by 58 votes. So although she managed to get the scale of the defeat down, the parliament still wasn't accepting it.
Perhaps she should have had another 5 or 6 down. Votes, and then eventually she could have gotten past the point of getting a majority.
Yeah, she stepped down. I think she realized that the Conservative Party, the parliamentary party, would not support her. And she wanted, the reason that it became a problem is that there was this issue about the backstop. And you remember we talked about that before, but in essence, the backstop was embedded in small print within this 500-page Chequers Agreement, as it became known as, which was that in the event that the United Kingdom didn't come to a trade agreement with the European Union, essentially, the UK would retain the customs union in order to obviate any problems between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And the Conservative Party, particularly the right of the Conservative Party, led by the likes of Jacob Rees-Mogg, the so-called European Research Group, they would not accept that. And the consequence essentially is that they didn't vote for her. She needed their votes. I think they had about 70 votes. But actually, as some people have said, the real reason that Theresa May didn't get the withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons was because the Labour Party wouldn't vote for it. And in many ways, the Labour Party now probably, many of them anyway, now regret that they didn't support Theresa May because they're saddled with Boris Johnson, and that's not worked out so well for them.
And that happened last summer, right? After May stepped down, Boris Johnson, sort of a right-wing bomb thrower, as we would call him here, a populist perhaps, a disruptor, was selected to be prime minister. And what happened with him?
Well, as you say, you describe him as a right-wing, did you say bomb thrower?
Somebody
who disrupts.
A disruptor.
Yeah. He's a mercurial character because he's also seen by many people as being on the left of the Conservative Party and socially very liberal. So, and of course, when he was mayor of London, he was very keen and very enthusiastic about immigration from the European Union. And that wasn't a problem. And of course, in London, and we're sure we'll talk about this in terms of the election result, there's a very different... London and the South East has a very different approach towards some of the issues which people in the North see as a problem for membership of the European Union. That is to say, people in London are far more receptive and accommodating to immigration from Europe, mainland Europe, whereas to people in northern towns and cities, it's more of a problem. And Boris Johnson, as mayor of London, was part of that spirit. You know, he was very, very open and very liberal. But when he became leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister, he did so really, pardon me, on a pledge that he would be anything but liberal, or certainly would take a very, very strong line on Brexit. He promised Brexit, and it was a very simple message that he gave, which he repeated in the election, was let's get Brexit done.
Right. And he repeated it enough that it became an effective slogan, didn't it?
Every time he appeared before the cameras, and that wasn't many because he's gaffe-prone. And he realized he had quite a big lead going into the election. So the election was called at the end of November. Beg your pardon, it was early November because it was about a 6-week campaign. And it was really called because the Lib Dems and the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party thought that they would do well in an election. And we had something called the Fixed Term Parliamentary Act. Now, this might interest you from a constitutional point of view. Mm-hmm. Under the Fixed Term Parliamentary Act, the last parliament was addled, as you might know. It was dysfunctional because the Conservatives didn't have an overall majority, because they depended upon the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland, and they lost their support as well. So by the time the election was called, I think the Conservatives... Once you take into account all of the defections from the Conservative Party, they were in a minority of about 40. Now, ordinarily, that would mean that the leader of the opposition would call a vote of no confidence, a vote of censure, as we call it, which, if supported, would mean that there would be an election. And you would think that if the leading party, the governing party, the Conservatives, don't have majority, then you would assume from that, perhaps, that they would lose the election. But I think everybody knew that they would win the election. And the Conservatives were very keen to have an election under their new leadership of Boris Johnson. And the Labour Party were very worried about having an election under Jeremy Corbyn, and we'll no doubt talk about him later. But the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party came to the view that they were doing well in the polls, and then would be a better time than any other time to have an election. So they eventually persuaded Labour to agree to an election. And the reason I say agree, just to complete my thought process here, we have this act now called the Fixed Terms Parliament Act. And of course, the last election was 2017. So we weren't scheduled to have an election until 2022, because it's a 5-year fixed term parliament. Now, that can be breached if 2/3 of the House of Commons agree to have an early election. I know we've spoken about this before, but we do have these parliamentary conventions or constitutional conventions. And I know, you know, you're interested in how the British Constitution works.
We would call them norms, and we've been busting through one norm after another over here. But yeah, I see what you're saying. You're not talking about calling a convention. You're talking about simply a way of doing things.
That's right. We call them constitutional conventions, which is to say a protocol, mm-hmm. which has stood the test of time, arisen over the period of time. I think last time we were talking about the prorogation of Parliament.
Right.
And you were asking me, well, what does the word prorogation mean? And under what power can the Prime Minister just prorogue Parliament, which is essentially to suspend Parliament? And at the time, I gave you a silly answer, which was I was flummoxed, and I said I didn't know. But I do know the answer now, and I knew it then. It's a parliamentary convention. It's just one of the powers that is reserved to the Prime Minister. They're essentially called royal prerogative powers. Now, I know, for example, in your country, only Congress can declare war, whereas in our country, until recently, declaring war was really in the gift of the Prime Minister. And it was something that Parliament would just have to go along with. Now, that has changed, and we won't talk about that now because it's probably not relevant. But it's an illustration of these constitutional conventions or these royal prerogative powers. And one of them was for the Prime Minister of the day just to call an election. But in 2010, when David Cameron came in with the Liberal Democrats in a coalition government, the Liberal Democrats wanted some constitutional changes, and one of them was to say, we don't like this idea that at any time, at the drop of a hat, the Prime Minister can call an election. It gives far too much power to the Prime Minister and far too little power to Parliament. And so that was changed. A new act was introduced, which was called the Fixed Term Parliamentary Act.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and my guest today is William Walton, a fellow I met when he was teaching at the University of Northumbria in England, and he is a British expert on all things having to do with the American Constitution. Our subject today, however, is Brexit. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking via Skype with William Walton, formerly a professor at the University of Northumbria in Britain, currently a civil servant, but he continues his interest in constitutional law, both American and British, and there's no bigger constitutional issue in Britain these days than Brexit. We've been discussing the pivotal election of 2019, and before the break, Bill was telling us that it took an extraordinary majority in Parliament to call that election because of something called the Fixed Term Act.
I should say that very quickly on that, I say that the Prime Minister can call an election. He does have to have Liz's authority to do so. He would have to go and see Liz in Buckingham Palace and say, look, I want to call an election. And Liz would have to say, yes, I agree. But it's probably viewed by constitutional authorities. It would be very unlikely for the Queen to deny the Prime Minister the right to hold an election. But she might do. She might say, I don't see the need for an election. Can't somebody else form a government? But anyway, this power was taken away by the Fixed Term Parliamentary Act. But because 2/3 of the Parliament agreed to hold an election, on December the 9th, we had an election. Sorry, I've been rambling for the last...
No, you haven't been. So that basically covers Boris Yeltsin's early prime ministership before the election. So he wanted it. Other parties thought they could win more seats, but it turns out that Johnson and his party really sort of swept the field, didn't they?
They did, and they went into the election, as I say, quite high in the opinion polls. And just to give you some figures, which I've written down here for your listeners, and they're probably broadly familiar with them, I suspect, but the The Conservatives won 365 of the 650 seats. So there are 650 seats in the House of Commons, and they won 365. You have to win 326 to form a government. In other words, half plus one.
Right, so they've got about a 40-seat majority.
No, they've got an 80-seat majority.
Oh, excuse me, my arithmetic, when I'm doing it in my head, yes, I did it in half.
Yeah, it's about an 80-seat majority, which is the largest Conservative majority, I think, since the second Thatcher term back in the early 80s. These things are slightly complicated because Sinn Féin don't take their seats. And I think they had seven seats in the previous parliament. I think they lost two, so it's down to five. So it's not 650, it's 645, something like that. And then there's also the complicating factor that the Speaker is an MP but doesn't vote on bills.
And you have a new Speaker now too, because the old Speaker, who was very...
We do. John Bercow stepped down. He was very colourful and I think was a very good Speaker, but a lot of people think that a lot of MPs, and particularly on the Tory side, thought that he overstepped the mark and was rewriting the Constitution. But perhaps maybe that's we could talk about that later on, perhaps.
Okay. So a major victory for the Conservatives, or the Tories, as they're sometimes called. Part of that, I mean, Labour thought they had some juice going into this election, and so did the Lib Dems, but what happened to them?
Well, I think the one thing we haven't discussed yet is, if you remember beforehand, back in October, I might have mentioned this, there was a thinking that the next election, whenever that would be a four-way fight, a fight between the Conservatives, the Labour Party, the Lib Dems, and the Brexit Party. Now, I've excluded the Scottish National Party because essentially they dominate Scotland. So they're a little side issue, although they do win a lot of seats. But within England and Wales, the thinking was that the Brexit Party, led by Nigel Farage, which is essentially a reincarnation of the UK Independence Party, which was previously led by Nigel Farage, and then about five or six other people after that, the Brexit Party emerged and did fabulously well in the local government elections in April of last year, and also in the European elections. Your listeners might be surprised to know that notwithstanding that majority of people voted in 2016 to leave the European Union, in spring of 2019, because we were still a member of the European Union, we were forced to participate in European elections for members of the European Parliament. And they were quite well contested because people were suddenly very interested in the European Parliament. And they often use these, what they might regard, some people might regard them as, how would you say, they're almost like free hits. The local elections and European elections are opportunities for people to express their dissatisfaction with a particular party, usually the government of the day. And the Conservatives, I think, came fourth or fifth, the lowest ever in a national election.
So the other parties, again, were feeling confident based upon those local returns.
And I think that's what led to this view by the Liberal Democrat Party elected a new leader, Jo Swinson, a lady from Glasgow, a woman from Glasgow, became the new leader. She was quite feisty, and she announced at the start of the election campaign in November that she was going to be the next Prime Minister, which was a rather ambitious claim or a rather ambitious statement, because the Liberal Democrats at that time, I think they had about 18 or 19 MPs. They'd garnered an extra five or six through defections, through the Brexit process, really the adult parliament, a number of MPs left. And if you remember, there was dissatisfaction amongst some Labour MPs about the anti-Semitism. So some Jewish Labour MPs left the party and they formed their own party briefly, and that didn't do particularly well. So some of them moved over to the Liberal Democrat Party. But the point is, the Liberal Democrats had just a small clutch of MPs, 18 or 19, in November. And they thought, I think, that it was going to be a four-way fight. And the thinking was that if the Brexit Party participated, a lot of Conservative voters would defect from the Tories and vote for the Brexit Party. And that didn't happen because there was pressure from within the Brexit Party, from a lot of the candidates, to say to Nigel Farage, actually, we shouldn't be fighting this. This might sound rather strange, they became candidates, but they came to the view that if the Brexit Party were successful, it could actually be at the expense of securing Brexit, because it could lead to a Jeremy Corbyn government. And the Jeremy Corbyn part of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn had committed itself to holding a second referendum on the European Union, membership of the European Union, if Labour won the election, which, of course, they had a good chance of doing. And so a lot of candidates in the Brexit Party said, well, now that Labour has adopted this we want a second referendum approach or stance, we run the risk of denying Boris Johnson a majority, essentially torpedoing him, and having the worst outcome that we could possibly imagine, which is having no Brexit at all. The argument of the Brexit Party was the Brexit offered by Theresa May and then later by Boris Johnson wasn't an authentic Brexit. And maybe, again, we might discuss that in a minute or two. But it does come down to this view as to what does Brexit mean and which party was most likely to deliver an authentic Brexit.
Or a hard Brexit, as you often call it, which basically means severing all ties and doing so pretty much at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. So an authentic Brexit in the eyes of the right wing of the Conservative Party and in the eyes of those people in the Brexit Party, as you say, would be severing ties completely with the European Union and reverting to World Trade Organization trading rules and not having anything to do with the single market or the customs union, which are the two elements of the European Union essentially by which we trade. And the right wing wanted to essentially to not have anything to do with that. I also should just say briefly that the Labour Party came to this view that it would support a referendum after a lot of internal fighting. Prior to that, in the 3 years up to about summer of 2019, they had pursued a policy of what was called constructive ambiguity, which was to say, well, we agree with Brexit because the people have spoken, but we want our own, we want a Labour form of Brexit, which would protect jobs, environmental standards, product standards, consumer standards, and so on. But I think people on the right of the Labour Party, centrists who were pro-European Union, said, well, what does that mean? You know, it doesn't really mean much. We have to be clear. And there was a feeling in the Labour Party that they were likely to lose more supporters towards the Lib Dems, who had a very pro-European Union position, than they were to the Brexit Party. And there was a view or a statistic that to every one voter they would lose to the Brexit Party, they would lose three to the Lib Dems. So the point I'm trying to make is that the Labour Party, going back to their vote in 2017 and the 2016 referendum, essentially the Labour Party were more at risk perhaps than any of the other parties because they had large numbers of voters who supported either side of the argument or both sides of the argument. Well, not at the same time. They had large numbers of their voters were pro-Brexit and very large numbers.
Well, that brings up a very important point, and I'll just bounce this idea off you and you can tell me whether I'm right or not or whether you think it's plausible. Many people have suggested that Labour did so poorly for two reasons. One is that Jeremy Corbyn has issues and is not a good campaigner and had been ambiguous about this. The other is, of course, something you mentioned briefly, that there were allegations, at least, of some anti-Semitic statements that he or others in the party had made. And so that was peeling off some support. But I'm just wondering if this entire strategy of constructive ambiguity may be of what really tanked them, because that goes back to Boris Johnson's extremely effective slogan, you know, let's get Brexit done. And when you've got a populace in Britain that is just tired of all of this, they don't want to elect a party that is still debating what they want with regard to Brexit.
I think so. What Labour's position was going into the election was, if Labour wins and has an overall majority in the House of Commons, then Labour will negotiate its own deal with the European Union for withdrawal. Having negotiated that deal, They will then put that to the country in a referendum, and the alternative being remaining in the European Union. So people said, well, hang on a moment, are you trying to tell us that your strategy is to negotiate a deal with the European Union, whilst the European Union negotiators will know that actually you might not support that in your own referendum? What will the Labour Party say to members of the public going into the referendum, that if there were to be a second referendum? Would they support their own deal, which they had negotiated, or would they support remaining in the European Union? Now, Jeremy Corbyn went into the election and he said, I will stay absolutely neutral.
That's just not going to sell. When you've got people who are just sick and tired of this, they want resolution one way or the other, and he's basically offering them no resolution at all. But we need to get beyond the election and talk about the present day. Just one last footnote, though. You mentioned Jo Swenson, the head of the Liberal Democrats, declared that she was going to be the next prime minister. What happened to her?
Well, you probably know by asking that question, she lost her seat.
Yeah. Wow.
She lost her seat in Glasgow. And can I just one other thing about the election, because this is an important point which we haven't touched upon. What was absolutely historic in this election, and this may have been reported quite widely on your side of the Atlantic, is that the Conservative Party under Boris Johnson won seats in traditional working class Labour areas that they had not won in 100 years or more. The trend was set at about 1 o'clock in the morning when the Conservatives won a seat called Blythe Valley. Now, Blythe Valley is up here in the northeast of England. It's a former coal mining area on the coast about 15, 20 miles north of Newcastle. Those are the Blythe Valley, Bassett Law, places, former mining areas in Derbyshire and in Yorkshire. These are areas in which people are born with Labour Party rosettes. These are places, constituencies, where the Labour Party weighed their votes at elections. The idea that they would ever lose these constituencies was unthinkable. And it was sometimes referred to as the Red Wall, this sort of area of Northern England, the metropolitan, urban Northern England, and small town Northern England, where the Conservatives would never win. And yet, on December the 9th, they won many of these seats. And the only seat that Labour won all night, which they hadn't won, in other words, a gain, was Putney in southwest London. And one Leaver MP, Caroline Flint, who lost her seat in Rotherham, which again is a former steel-making city, she said, I don't think losing 60 seats in northern towns is a good return for winning one seat in southwest London.
I think she's probably right. And I can simply say, Bill, that we saw a similar realignment in our 2016 election that had actually been moving in that direction ever since. We have a lot of coal mining regions and sort of post-industrial regions that have been suffering mightily right here in central Appalachia, for example, who for many, many decades had supported the Democratic Party, which is generally speaking more pro-labor and more pro-union. And one by one, the Republicans picked them off, and it was basically on social issues and immigration in particular. And so perhaps there's been a similar sentiment there. But okay, now the Tories have this commanding lead in Parliament. They've got an 80-vote majority, which is probably unassailable on most issues. What is Johnson going to do? I guess it looks like Brexit's going to get done. When is it going to get done?
Well, within a week of coming to power, or within a fortnight, because of course the election was held just before Christmas. So just before the adjournment at Christmas, the Conservatives managed to get through the withdrawal bill, a new withdrawal bill which they'd negotiated with the European Union. So they essentially, it was a redrafting of Theresa May's deal. It's not very different. But instead of the backstop, it has what some people call the front stop, which is a rather complicated arrangement concerning Northern Ireland. And it was really that which provided the distinction between the two.
Isn't that where they drew the imaginary line in the ocean between?
That's right. There's an imaginary line down the middle of the North Sea, which separates Northern Ireland from mainland United Kingdom. And in essence, any product that is exported to Northern Ireland from, let's say, England, if there is a good reason to believe it's then going to be continue its journey to Ireland, that its final destination will be Ireland. So let's say you make a car in Derby in England, and it's exported to Northern Ireland, and it's eventually going to carry on to Ireland, to Dublin, then one will pay in advance a tariff. If it stays in Northern Ireland, you would pay that tariff and then claim it back. It's a rather complicated.
But it looks awfully like a national
process.
Border.
But that's the basis which the European Union agreed.
Right, and it looks awfully like a national border that you've now drawn between Britain on the one side and Northern Ireland on the other side, and that's why they still object. But now that the DUP,
right.
the Northern Ireland Party, no longer is necessary for the Conservatives to have a governing majority, and so they can agree to this even if the DUP decides to vote against it.
Exactly. The DUP are now an irrelevance. And the other thing that Boris Johnson did, by the way, before the election, in order to prevent any repeat of what happened previously, is that if you wanted to be a Conservative candidate in the 2019 election, you had to sign a pledge stating that you would support the withdrawal agreement. Hmm. So you couldn't have people like Dominic Grieve, who's an MP for Beaconsfield, who's now lost his seat and has left Parliament, or Anna Soubry, the MP for Nottingham Broxton, these thorn in the sides of the Conservative Party who were very strong pro-Remain. Those people just don't exist anymore. And you have a party now which those pro-European elements have been expunged, which I think is a great shame because they claim to be a one-nation party. And I don't think it's true anymore to say that they represent a cross-section of the nation. But that's the way it is within the Conservative Party. But it's, of course, very practical for Boris Johnson to do that in terms of, well, let's make sure that we don't have any repetitions of the shenanigans that went on in Parliament.
So it looks like Boris Johnson is riding high. He's not only got an 80-seat majority in Parliament, he's got the majority he wants. That are all pro-Brexit, so Parliament has now approved a withdrawal bill. Okay, so does that mean, is Brexit now done?
No, it doesn't, because stage two, really, and in fact, in many ways, the fun is only just going to begin. Stage two is the negotiation with the European Union of a trade deal. There's nothing about a trade deal in the withdrawal bill. All there was in the withdrawal bill is in the agreement with the European Union. There's a 500 pages, as I say, essentially on resolving the three issues I mentioned at the start of this talk, which are sort of platitudes concerning the aspirations for the two parties or the two entities, the United Kingdom and the European Union, as to the nature of their future relationship.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is William Walton, formerly of the University of Northumbria, an expert on American and British constitutional law, who's telling us all about Brexit. And now let's finish our conversation with William Walton, all about Brexit and how it's finally looking like it's going to get done here in January of 2020. But even if Brexit does occur on January 31st, 2020, there are several outstanding issues that remain to be resolved. Bill, remind me, what are those three issues that remain to be resolved by this agreement?
Right, the three issues, just going back to the start, were the status of European citizens living in the United Kingdom, the issue of how much money we owe to the European Union in terms of outstanding commitments, etc., and the Northern Ireland border.
Okay. Those three things have still not been resolved.
Well, the Northern Ireland border has. I'm not sure the issue of the status of European citizens is on its way to resolution, but I wouldn't say it's been completely resolved. And the amount of money we owe the European Union, I don't think that has been resolved. But I think it was the Northern Ireland border that was... The British government always said under Theresa May, and I think under Boris Johnson, there was never any suggestion that they would be unfair or unprincipled against French citizens, Polish citizens who'd moved to the United Kingdom and settled here. And I think that would have not gone down well with the British people. You know, there is a fairness in the British people, and nobody wanted to see the rights of those people denied. Not in large numbers. I'm sure there'd be one or two, but it was really the Northern Ireland issue which was the central issue, the difficulty. But now the difficulty is the extent of friction and alignment with the European Union in terms of trade deals. And if I just very briefly, the right of the Conservative Party, their view of Brexit is, well, Brexit is an opportunity for the United Kingdom to go a separate way from the European Union. So we see divorce as a good thing because we'll be able to set our own trade deals with other countries around the world and set our own standards. Now, of course, the United States is very involved in this conversation, or relevant to this conversation, because there are all these talks in Britain about, well, will we have to pare down our standards to those of the United States in terms of agriculture? And I'm not, perhaps I shouldn't have said that, but what I meant was there are scare stories in Britain about American agricultural standards. I'm sure there are scare stories the other way around after all we have mad cow disease a few years ago.
But it's things like allowing antibiotics with farm animals.
Yeah, it's things like that.
Which we're a little bit more permissive on than you are.
Yeah. And the question is Brexit an opportunity for the United Kingdom to become a sort of Singapore of Europe with what one might call a low regulatory standard, low wage, free market economy? Or is Brexit really simply just a cosmetic change and the United Kingdom would become or would remain very closely aligned with the standards in the European Union? And of course, you know, pundits say, well, this is perhaps the first time anywhere in human history where you've had a trade deal between two entities, the European Union and the United Kingdom, where they start from perfect alignment, because we've been a member of the European Union for 40 years. So we have to have all of the standards and the rules and regulations which the European Union has. So we are already aligned. It's not as if we're trying to do a deal with, say, North Korea or Singapore, you know, where you may have very, very different standards concerning the environment, health, product standards.
But you may have much the same problem, though, because if the hard Brexiteers really do want to go their own way and create a Singapore in the North Atlantic, then they're going to have to convince the European Union in any trade agreement to accept that. And maybe the EU doesn't want to accept those things.
Exactly. No, you've put your thumb on it. You're absolutely spot on, because the European Union essentially is saying, if you want a realignment, if you want to depart and you want a lot of friction and not alignment, this is the way it's being presented, then we're not going to give you a very good trade deal. But if you're prepared to be closely aligned and even have what's called dynamic alignment, and dynamic alignment essentially means if the European Union tomorrow or next year introduces a stricter standard on, let's say petroleum that you put in cars, emission standards or something like that, then the United Kingdom will adopt that. Well, of course, those on the right of the Conservative Party say, well, that's not why we wanted Brexit. I mean, the whole point of Brexit is to have our own laws, our own borders, our own controls. And
I just don't know how realistic that is. I mean, I don't mean to take sides in your political fight, but just from my disinterested perspective, Britain is leaving the biggest trade bloc in the world, which has enormous power and has negotiated deals with other big trade blocs and big countries around the world.
Canada.
Exactly, and the United States too, and has this enormous power, and now with all due respect,
it doesn't have an agreement with the United States.
Oh well, then my mistake. It's
not,
a big,
not of anything of any significance.
It's a big, powerful trade bloc, the EU is, and Britain, for all of its virtues, is a much smaller entity.
Yeah.
And the idea that Britain, with all of its virtues, is much smaller, and it's not going to be able to dictate terms to the EU, nor, with all due respect to the United States, nor to China. For trade deals to work, you've got to have mutuality. You've got to have agreement. And I think maybe the Brexiteers, the hard Brexiteers, are overestimating the bargaining position that Britain will find itself in when Brexit is finally done.
Well, I'm not dissenting from what you say. And there is this, on the one hand, you hear the likes of Nigel Farage, who's obviously not in the Conservative Party, but represents that strand of thought of hard Brexit. And his view essentially can be summed up that there's a bigger world out there, that the European Union, although a large entity, is shrinking in terms of its proportion of world trade, and that the countries that are growing in the world are the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and then the next set of countries that are emerging, such as Turkey.
Well, that may have been true back in 2016, but I don't think those countries have done quite so well over the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, they may not have done, but I'm not. I don't have the figures to hand in terms of the scale. But of course, the thing about the European Union is that it's next door.
Yes, I mean that's going to be in some sense your natural trading partners.
Channel to Calais, and so trading with France and Germany and Spain is infinitely easier than trading with Japan or Indonesia. And I think part of the problem is, or a large part of the problem, is that there's still a very big hangover from the days of empire. You know, there were people talking in the election and in the referendum in 2016 about, well, you know, we were once a great country and we were Great Britain and we don't need the German. You know, there's often a degree of anti-German sentiment, I'm sad to say, but also anti-French sentiment as well, because we never liked the French anyway. You know, they're always good for a bit of baiting and as a target. And so there's a sort of sentiment, well, by those on the right, which is that Britain, you know, would be better outside the European Union and could strike its own deals with the likes of, you know, the United States and Indonesia, etc. And on the other hand, on the other side of the spectrum, there are those who say that's just fantasy. It's just kind of cuckoo land. And it's not founded in any truth.
So in other words, make Britain great again.
Yeah, it's sort of... It's just sentiment. It's sentimental stuff that's about 60, 100 years out of date.
I'm afraid, William, that we have a similar sentiment here, and I tend to think of it as post-World War II sentiment. You know, in the 1940s and 50s, and extending even into the 60s and 70s, the United States was the dominant international power, and perhaps reached its apotheosis with the fall of the Berlin Wall and the fall of the Soviet Union. But, you know, that was because much of the rest of the world was in ruins and still not having recovered. But under the international regime that we and Britain put together, well, thank heaven, the rest of the world did recover, or much of it did. And it's just natural then that the relative balance of power is no longer going to be so one-sided. But I think there are some people in our country who look back on those halcyon days and they want to turn back the clock to 1950 or just assume that the U.S. has the same level of power and prestige and influence that it had in 1955. And times have changed. And so I'm afraid that there are similar sentiments in both of our countries. Okay, so we're going to have Brexit in a few days. Is it going to be in January of 2020?
Well, that's right. It's the final day of this month.
January 31st. Okay, so in January 31st, 2020, you know, technically Brexit happens. Does that mean everything comes to a halt, or do current arrangements, trading arrangements, stay in place while the continuing negotiations go forward?
Yeah, there will be an extension. There is an extension at the moment, or there's a transition period, which theoretically ends on, I think, the last day of June, but with the facility to extend it by 6 months to the end of 2020, by the end of this year, in other words, to the 31st of December. And the thinking and the expectation is that will be extended in order to facilitate continued negotiations. But the new president of the European Union, Ursula von der Leyen, I don't know if you've heard of her, but she was over in London last week. She is an Anglophile. She was educated in London at the London School of Economics, and she's also an Americanophile. So she has a great affinity for the United Kingdom and the United States. But she made it very clear last week that if you want a trade deal, then you've got to accept the free movement of labour, as well as the free movement of capital and goods. We want the free movement of capital and goods, and the free movement of the four fundamental freedoms. But you're not keen on the free movement of labour. And if you don't accept the free movement of labour, you won't find the European Commission will be very enthusiastic about striking up a trade deal with you. So Britain, the Boris Johnson-led government will have to determine itself as to how much friction it wants or how much alignment it wants. And if it wants to depart from the European Union in terms of standards, etc., then the European Union has said, don't expect a good trade deal.
Well, forgive me again. I'm a foreigner and I'm opining on British politics, but it doesn't seem to me from across the Atlantic that Johnson has gotten Brexit done at all. I mean, he's moved in that direction. He's got a commanding parliamentary majority, but it's been effectively nothing is going to change as of February 1st.
That's correct. I think, I'll give you an example, actually, of something that may change. We've just had a regional airline announce it's in financial difficulty. Some of your listeners may have been to Britain and may have flown on. It's called Flybe. It's actually part owned by Delta Airways in the United States. Now, it flies essentially from one peripheral part of Britain to another. So if you want to fly from Aberdeen to Exeter in Devon, you could fly with Flybe, and they fly little small planes, and they have, you know, small numbers of people travelling. So they're a niche operator, but they're in financial difficulty, and the British government said, well, we will allow you to defer paying your corporate tax for the year. And British Airways immediately said, and Virgin, well, you can't do that British Airways and EasyJet said, you can't do that because that's a form of assisted state aid, and that's contrary to European Union rules. Now, this is the sort of argument that the Corbynistas, the Jeremy Corbyn people, have often said, well, the problem with the European Union is that essentially it's a free market organisation. And if you were to ever have a very left-wing radical Labour government that wanted to take control of the commanding heights of the British economy by nationalising certain sectors, that would be very difficult. And it's often been said, for example, that Labour's desire to nationalise or renationalise our railway network would run into trouble with the European Union.
So that accounts for the people in Labour who might be allowed. That accounts for the people in Labour who might favour Brexit. Well, we're running out of time here, William. This is fascinating. We could talk about it forever. But one important question that, of course, everyone's waiting on to hear is, on January 31st, is Big Ben going to bong to commemorate Brexit?
Well, Big Ben has been decommissioned for quite some time now. So mm-hmm. Ordinarily, of course, it would bong every hour anyway. And because it's been decommissioned, it hasn't rung or bonged for some months now. And
so I guess that's
Mark
a big
Ransomer,
no.
Who's a right-wing Conservative MP, he wants it to bong. And what they've said is, well, it will cost about £500,000 to get it to bong. I'm not quite sure why the payment is necessary. But as somebody said, that's about £50,000 a bong. And doesn't seem very good value for money.
No. So, last question then.
Are going to be parties in London. The suggestion that there's going to those on the right want a celebration. And in fairness, look, you know, there is a serious point here about it's been very divisive, as you know. People have very, very strong feelings on either side. And for many people, it's going to be a very, very sad occasion when we leave the European Union formally. And many people are concerned that if people are too vitriolic about it, then or too victorious, sorry, about it, and they may want to rub, you know, the faces of the losers into the ground, that will just incur even more resentment. So there are quite serious issues about how this occasion is marked.
Well, last question, and the one the whole world is waiting to hear. Is there any truth to the rumor that Meghan and Harry are disembarking for North America because they don't like Brexit?
Well, I think this is what's been called Megxit.
Yes, Megxit.
You may have heard that.
Yes,
that's the term we now use in Britain.
I have heard that, but I just made up that entire conspiracy theory that they're leaving because of that. So I hope I'm not propagating untruths around the world. But I had heard of Megxit.
Well, we'll have you in the Tower if you're going to say those things. Well, we'll get you extradited and put you in the Tower of London. We can't have people saying that about our monarchy. it's become a bit of a circus, hasn't it? And it's become, and I think you know, Prince Harry is actually a very well-adjusted, entertaining young chap, and I think, like a lot of people, I have a lot of sympathy for his desire just to lead an ordinary life.
All right. Well, William Walton, thank you very much for enlightening us once more about the continuing saga of Brexit, and given the pace of this entire process, we'll probably talk another half dozen times about it. Thanks.
Okay.
Across the road from the Montpelier Estate on Virginia Route 20 stands a little white one-story house with a red door. This little house is called the Gilmore Cabin. The cabin was originally built in 1873 by George Gilmore, an emancipated slave for the Montpelier property, then owned by James Madison's great-nephew, Dr. James A. Madison. George Gilmore rapidly ascended in economic and social standing. The 1880 census listed him as a farmer rather than a laborer. George's wife Polly contributed greatly to the family's income by working as a seamstress, a fact corroborated by both archaeological findings and oral history. George lived to be 95 years old, passing away as a yeoman farmer in the year 1905. He and Polly are buried on the Gilmore Cabin property. The DuPont family acquired the Gilmore Cabin in 1920, and the Montpelier Foundation later took ownership of the property and fully restored the cabin in 2005. This is Tyler Stanley with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our guest, William Walton, our go-to guy on all things Brexit. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And before we go, make sure and check us out online. We got over 400 podcasts of previous episodes available to you. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're everywhere. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment and perhaps the British experiment as well.